Welcome back, everyone. I'm George Knapp, your guest host this week for Coast to Coast AM. I'm joined now by Richard Dolan. He has a master's degree in history from the University of Rochester. He's an historian and an author. And the book he wrote, he published in 2000, this 500-page study called UFOs and the National Security State, is must reading for anyone who's been involved in this topic or have an interest in it. Whitley Strieber called it the best history ever written about UFOs. It looks into all the allegations that many of us are familiar with, the paper trail of how the cover-up began, disinformation, and a lot more. A couple of weeks ago, I was in Denver for the Mutual UFO Network International Symposium and had a chance to not only meet Richard Dolan, but to hear him speak. It is fascinating, it's scintillating, and I'd have to tell you, in some ways, Richard, it's awfully depressing, isn't it?
Yes, it is, George. I want to thank you, by the way, for having me on the show tonight.
Absolutely. I wouldn't miss it. You were at the top of the list. Let's talk a little bit about what your new thesis is, or at least the evolving thesis. I mean, sure. What you outlined in Denver at that presentation, an extension of the foundation you established in your excellent book, it deals with the New World Order, except for you're not warning that the New World Order is around the corner. You're saying it's already here.
Yeah, I guess I have been coming to that feeling. It's interesting because when I wrote my book, UFOs and the National Security State, I really researched and wrote it during the late 1990s. My approach was at all times to be as careful and cautious and even as conservative almost as I could be. I say almost because you always have to go to where the data leads you. But my approach was never to grandstand my conclusions. And so, like, for example, in that book, it's very much, I think, a straightforward historical narrative and interpretation, but low-key interpretation on what I think was going on and really just trying to explain things. What has happened since I finished that book, and I've been telling people every year, well, I'm deep in the heart of the next book, and I am, is that I continue to think through what I believe is going on. And one of the conclusions that I've come to is simply that the UFO cover-up, right from the beginning, necessitated, let's call it an end run around our normal constitutional processes in this country, and I'm now convinced in other countries as well. So that in order to hide a secret this big, you had to, by default, in a sense, create extra governmental procedures such as black budget activities and other covert activities that the public is never aware of and that your elected officials are never aware of and that therefore are beyond your normal government. And so that the cover-up of UFOs has subverted our traditional constitutional government. Now, that's an argument I was coming to a few years ago in which I was arguing that UFO secrecy was one of several knives in the back of the traditional American republic. I still believe that's absolutely true. I've been trying to take that analysis a little bit further now. So it's not simply that UFO secrecy has killed off our republic so that we have basically this walking corpse of a republic, still wearing the old clothes, as it were, but there's a dead body in there. But it's further now, because to understand this problem on a worldwide basis means to go beyond simply the structure of the U.S. government cover-up. I mean, true, the U.S. government, the U.S. military is the most powerful in the world by itself, although I think it's argued that the U.S. military and U.S. government are in some decline. But to look at it internationally required me really in the last year or so to rethink yet again what's going on. And this is where it gets even more depressing, as you put it. Because what we've had is a kind of transnational revolution, I think without even most of us realizing it, actually. I mean, we lived through the 1980s and 90s, and I think it was during that period of time in which a lot of the organs were kind of put in place, as it were, to remove sovereignty out of the hands of most people who live in most countries and put them into transnational organizations. And the reason I think this is important regarding UFO secrecy is that I think the foundation of UFO secrecy is not simply a bunch of concerned politicians at the top of the heap saying, well, we need to protect the public from the reality of this because they're just going to spaz out and panic and we don't want people jumping out of windows. I don't think that that is the reason for the secrecy.
You think it's a vehicle or a reason, a vehicle through which they move into some new world order?
Well, I think that the secrecy is yes, you could call it a vehicle by which they move into this. But I guess what I'm saying is that the secrecy of UFOs is not in order to protect the public from the truth, but rather to protect acquired technology and hardware, I think is a big part of it. And so, it's also my belief that that technology has become privatized so that it's gone outside of formal government control, and I think it went outside formal control a long time ago. So that the way I look at it now is that you have a private international group of people who have access to exotic technology, and they have no incentive, as far as I can see, for sharing this with the rest of the world. And so they use international, there are a lot of ways to control world activities from an international stage. I mean, on the one level, you can certainly just buy off and get your hooks into any national government you're interested in. The greatest prize of all, I think, is the United States government, which has, I think, been under control of other interests for a long time.
By that, you mean multinational corporations.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But there are other legal structures they have, such as here in Western Hemisphere, we got NAFTA, GATT, there's the IMF, there's the World Bank. I think these institutions are important, and I don't think they've gotten enough attention, not simply from UFO researchers, but just from political researchers in general, to really understand the power that these organizations have. So here I am, you know, working out of my little office in Rochester, New York, trying to figure out the UFO cover-up, and I'm looking more and more at some of these larger international structures, trying to figure it all out. I can't say that I have the final answer, by the way. But what I have are a couple of pretty good ideas, and I continue to try to research them and dig deeper and deeper.
Well, hold that thought for a second, Richard. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with Richard Dolan, and I'm going to be asking him what it is that's being covered up exactly. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp, your guest host, and my guest is historian Richard Dolan, author of UFOs and the National Security State. Richard, I'm looking at your book here in front of me, and there's an interesting quote in it in the introduction about Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader. And you say a friend of yours wrote that we think we're Luke Skywalker when we're actually Darth Vader, talking about America. What do you mean by that?
We all grow up, we love our country, don't we? I grew up in a very patriotic household. My dad was a Marine and a cop, flag waving all the way. And I would hazard to guess that that's the case with 95%+ of the people listening to this show. And we have a lot of reasons for loving our country, for loving the people in it, for being proud of our political tradition. I'm very proud of the American political tradition over the several centuries of the exploration of the concept of freedom and individual liberty. So there's a lot to love. What's happened is that a snake has gotten into our Garden of Eden, and that snake has gotten to be more and more powerful over the years. And I think what's happened is that most people aren't really fully aware, or I think maybe more and more people are becoming aware these days, that we've got some problems, and that America... we like to think that America is constantly the good guy going around in the world trying to make this world a safer and better place. But there are other ways of looking at American policy globally, and they're not all benign. And so that's exactly what my friend meant, and that's exactly why I included it into my book.
You think that we are, in essence, using our government authority, our military might, to carry out the aims of multinational corporations that may not necessarily be in the best interests of the country as a whole?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's probably a much clearer way to put it than I just did. What we've had is our government's been hijacked by multinationals, by very powerful interests. Think of it this way. Imagine if you're some multi-billion dollar interest corporation and you're twiddling your thumbs one day thinking, gee, what government can I influence today? How can I make my money grow? Well, certainly, I mean, trying to influence, peddle influence within governments is something that major players and powerful people have been trying to do since kingdom come, right? But the U.S. government is the most powerful and really the most attractive of targets of all because it controls the most powerful military in the world. And so if you can get that military to do work for you, invade countries on your behalf and secure oil fields on your behalf or privatize natural resources on your behalf, then, I mean, that's the greatest gig in the world for you. And this is exactly, I think, what's been happening for a long time.
Who do you suppose knows? I mean, do you suppose this president knows? I mean, he certainly fits the model that you're describing. And do you think it goes beyond merely giving out sweetheart deals to Halliburton to feed the troops in Iraq?
Well, how much this president knows is something that I'm not privy to. But what you can say, just by analyzing his actions, is that he as you say, he fits the bill. He's been working from the get-go, even before 9/11, on behalf of these corporations. So, for example, I mean, there were campaign promises that George Bush made back in 2000 regarding environmental, like global warming type issues, as I recall, which he completely reversed direction in March or April of 2001, throwing out his promise to maintain certain carbon caps on industry and so forth. Those went right out the window, and it's just gone, you know, ever since. So yes, I think he fits the bill perfectly. Sweetheart deals, that's important, but I keep wondering that there are things beyond the sweetheart deals that are frightening. I mean, for example, why is the United States in these other countries to begin with? I mean, I wondered back in 2002, watching the CIA get decapitated by the president when it disagreed over the entire weapons of mass destruction issue. As you may recall, CIA analysts in 2002 and 2003 were not on board with the White House, you know, constant pounding of this drum of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And what happened was that CIA essentially got, you know, chopped off at the head, and compliant people were put within there to give the president reports that he wanted, which was that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. These were fictitious. I recall to this day watching Colin Powell give his famous little, you know, tap dance before the world with these huge visuals. You remember this?
I do, and that I came away from that thinking the same thing. Well, if that's true and Colin Powell is saying it, gosh, I guess we got to go.
Well, what I thought something different when I was watching it on, I don't know if it was CNN or wherever, but I kept thinking, BS, only saying it out loud, thinking, and I bet that three-quarters of the world was thinking it, but I thought maybe none of the people in the UN wanted to call out Colin Powell on it. So in other words, saying, well, you can't see this based on these intelligence photographs, but trust me, he said, our analysts have told us that these are sites of weapons of mass destruction. What's amazing about that, I collect a bunch of documentaries here, and I have one, which is a fairly sympathetic documentary on the CIA, in which a CIA analyst, a member of NPIC, National Photographic Interpretation Center, went on camera, it's like a year or two after the invasion, and he said, yeah, I was one of several members of NPIC sitting behind Colin Powell supporting him that day at the UN. And he said that was a tough day for us because, A, we, the NPIC guys, were not allowed to talk to the media. B, he said, and I'm not kidding here, we all knew none of those images showed any sign of weapons of mass destruction. Now I'm thinking, holy smokes, man. So you can't tell me Powell would not have known. You can't tell me the Bush administration would not have known. Condoleezza Rice, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, all these people, Cheney. Obviously, they had to know that there was no evidence there.
Hey, let's bring it back to UFOs for a second.
Yeah.
You know, I get asked this question all the time. I'm sure you do, too. Do you think the president knows? And, you know, what we've heard over the years, we don't know for sure, but that some do and some don't. There are stories that Ronald Reagan knew. I'm pretty sure that Bill Clinton didn't know because he was friends of mine had conversations with him, and he was curious about it but didn't know. Do you suppose this guy knows?
Yeah, it's a really great question. Does this president know? Because I've done my best, as you have, to try to study or to try to figure out, really, what these prior presidents knew or did not know. And it's a real roll of the dice because we're not privy to the information that they are privy to. Like you, George, I had information that Bill Clinton wanted to know, suspected certain things, but did not have actual confirmation of whether there was or wasn't, you know, an alien presence here. As far as the current president, I think it's the belief of a lot of researchers in this field that his father was in the know, George Bush Sr. If that is so, one might speculate that the son would know, except for this problem. When George Bush Jr. was a younger man, like during the Reagan White House years, he really was not held in high regard at all. There's a note in Ronald Reagan's diaries that just recently came out in which he speaks rather disparagingly of George W. Bush. So, as George Sr.'s ne'er-do-well son or something to this effect. So, I think it is possible that he might not be trusted with the truth. Now, on the other hand, this administration is about as military-friendly as you're going to get. So you might think that they would tell him. But the fact is, I don't know, and I wouldn't be willing to guess as to what George W. Bush knows. It might be that he's not as particularly interested in this. On the other hand, there are rumors that Dick Cheney has been in the know for a long time. In fact, when the Bush administration first came into power in 01, Dick Cheney did a spot on the Diane Rehm show on National Public Radio here in the United States. And UFO researcher, Canadian researcher, Grant Cameron, was actually able to get on the air to ask Cheney about UFOs. It was an amazing moment in 2001. And Cameron is a very responsible, really smart researcher. You know, said, I can't remember his exact question. Can you talk about UFOs? And Cheney said, well, if I could, I wouldn't be telling you. Words to that effect. That's really all we know about Cheney, but there has been suspicion that Cheney and indeed Rumsfeld, when he was Secretary of Defense, was in the know. Rumsfeld has a long history with this.
If your thesis is true that our government has basically been usurped by multinationals and that the UFO cover-up is part of that, perhaps even fewer people than normal than in previous years know about it anymore because the secret's been moved out of the government entirely.
Well, I think that to an extent that has happened. What going on a variety of inside leaks now, I mean, look, a leak is not the same thing as having a received government document in your hands. I understand that. My instinct was always to work off of proven, valid, non-arguable government documents and to make my case based on that, and I still do that. On the other hand, when you have one after another of high-level person talking about this topic on a quiet basis, I've had a number of contacts that I've cultivated, and I know you have as well. Some of my contacts are very prominent, and other prominent people are just, their information has come out. For example, Ben Rich, who used to run Lockheed's Skunk Works division. Ben Rich, before his death in the 1990s, made several statements about the nature of the UFO cover-up.
And can I hold you to that thought for just a moment, and we'll come back, and you can tell us what Ben Rich said. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be back with Rich Dolan in just a moment. Welcome back, everyone. I'm George Knapp. My guest is Rich Dolan, a historian, author of UFOs in the National Security State, a fascinating history of the UFO cover-up. Rich, right before we went to the break, you were talking about Ben Rich of Lockheed Skunk Works division, developer of some incredible airplanes over the years. What is it that he said related to UFOs that caught your attention?
There are, to my knowledge, three specific different statements that Ben Rich made that have come out over the years relating to UFOs. I'm sure there are more that have not come to light, but we know of three instances. There's a correspondence he had in 1986 with a friend, John Andrews, in which Ben Rich referred to UFOs as unfunded opportunities, underlining the U, the F, and the O. That's suggestive. That makes me think of crash retrievals myself, freebies, as it were. Maybe that's right. There's another statement that Ben Rich made toward the end of his life in 1993 while speaking at UCLA School of Engineering alumni, where he says, we now have the technology to take ET home, and spoke afterward with a number of interested people, one of whom I know and who recorded this, fellow named Jan Harzen, a senior executive and a member of MUFON. According to Jan, Rich said, we do now know how to travel to the stars. It's time to end all the secrecy on this, as it no longer poses a national security threat, and make the technology available for use in the private sector. And there are many in the intelligence community who would like to see this stay in the black and not see the light of day. The statement by Rich that I'm interested in our context, is through William McDonald, who also knew Rich. And after Ben Rich died, Bill McDonald wrote an article on Rich in which he talked about information Rich had given him over the years. And it was Rich's understanding that the UFO problem became formally removed out of the office of the president around the time of 1969, so around, say, the beginning of the Nixon administration, and that at that time it became international and private. That's according to William McDonald. I think that fits with a lot of things that we see in the larger world in terms of privatization of power. Consider that the Trilateral Commission was founded at almost around the same time, early 1970s, by David Rockefeller and with the assistance of Zbigniew Brzezinski. And the Trilateral Commission is an interesting case study because it's an example of private, very powerful individuals who basically walked into the Nixon White House, walked into Henry Kissinger's office as Secretary of State, and said, oh, by the way, we've just created this other organization to help the Nixon administration pursue the correct foreign policy. Which, you know, you think about the moxie that it took. But in other words, I guess what I'm saying is that we've started seeing a very significant privatization, internationalization of the loci of power. I think it was accelerating it around that time. And it would fit, in my opinion, that power would become more privatized at around this time.
I had a chance to interview Ben Rich. You'll recall that when the stealth fighter was announced to the world, you know, it had been flying around for years and years in the Nevada skies, and people had seen it and photographed it, but they unveiled it in the early 90s, and the unveiling took place at Nellis Air Force Base. So I went out there. I had seen the same correspondence you referred to, in which Ben Rich come pretty darn close to admitting that UFOs, both man-made and otherwise, are very real. Right. So I got to interview him, and I asked him point blank. I said, hey, a lot of people think that there's alien or ET technology in the stealth fighter. Any comment on it? And he smiled and paused and said, no, just good old American know-how. But it was a wry sort of a smile. And, of course, what else would he say to a mainstream reporter anyway? I wonder, do you think that Lockheed is one of those multinational corporations that has usurped the authority of the U.S. government?
Boy, that's a good question.
I guess you got to be careful for legal reasons about that, too.
Well, first of all, how can I know exactly? I think what happens is it's not even that multinationals usurp it. What I think happens is, I mean, after all, do we even know who are the major shareholders of a place like Lockheed or of General Motors or of General Electric? We really don't. Who are these people? A lot of that information is proprietary. So it's not easy for us to know. So that what I think has happened is that influence is peddled in very, very subtle ways. It's not like on the X-Files, where you got the cigarette-smoking man, you know, standing behind the FBI guy, telling him what he can and can't do. I just don't think it's that crass. I think it's much more subtle. So that there are a variety of private, personal relationships that develop among very powerful people who steer policy in certain ways. And that's how I think it happens. And whether it's specifically Lockheed or specifically General Motors or General Electric or Raytheon or Halliburton, or Bechtel, what I think happens is that these major players have people who are prominent within them who get on the in road, to the White House, and then they make things happen. So I don't want to go on record, first of all, saying that Lockheed's taken control of the United States government, because I don't know that for sure.
Plus you could have a knock at the door by tomorrow too from a lawyer.
Bingo.
Yeah.
But what I think, let me back up a little bit, because I don't think I fully explained my reason why I think this has all become privatized. Maybe a little bit. Go back to 1947, let's just say. Pretend that you're Harry Truman and that your top general or your science advisor, maybe Vannevar Bush, comes up to you and says, "Mr. President, we have acquired technology that does not appear to have been manufactured by human hands. It appears to be very exotic and from elsewhere." So now you're the president, you're forced to make this decision. Well, are you going to tell the world? And I think there's a very good chance you wouldn't. First of all, by telling the world, you're letting the Soviet Union know that you've got this exotic, very valuable technology, and you're not necessarily willing to share that. So what would you do? Well, I think, in the past, I've thought about this and thought that you would, you'd keep it secret and you'd try to get scientists to study it. But that's really only part of the solution. Which scientists would you have? Would the Air Force, let us say, within its own structure, have sufficient capability of analyzing and trying to replicate this technology? I'm thinking no. What I am thinking is that defense contractors, private contractors, would. They would have the infrastructure. They would have the scientists, the engineers, who are used to studying and building first-rate types of aircraft and machinery. And so what you would do, if you're the president, you would go to your top defense contractors, and you would say, "Hey, look, we've got this little piece of technology here, and I want you to study it. I want you to figure out what you can with it." Because they probably wouldn't be able to replicate it right away. I mean, this is, way, way, way beyond anything that we had, presumably. But what they might say, I could see this happening, is that they'd say, "Yeah, we'll take it, we'll study it, but of course, we get patents off of it." And presumably the government would say, "Fine, whatever, but we want to retain access to it." And I'm sure the lawyers would hammer it all out and work out whatever they need to. So that, in other words, the key is that much of this technology would become private, early on, in a sense, which is good for a number of reasons. A, it helps secrecy, because now you're not necessarily dealing with government documents implicating possession of alien technology. And also, B, we all know government and military and the defense industry is all a revolving door. A lot of these people leave government and they go into defense anyway and make huge amounts of money. So the culture is very congenial for sharing secrets with private industry. And indeed, even since the 1980s, there have been certain legal structures that have been formally put in place allowing private contractors to do highly classified covert work for the U.S. government. I don't think that's any big deal. So that, in other words, it's one thing to say there's a secret that there are UFOs and you don't want the public to panic, but it's another thing entirely to actually have hardware and to keep that secret. That requires dealing with more people to study this technology. It requires a different manner of secrecy. And privatizing, I think, is the effective way to go.
Well, let's talk about the idea of hardware and what that hardware might be. We're going to take a short break, and that's what we'll discuss and jump into, the nature of what's being covered up, as soon as we come back. I'm George Knapp, your guest host on Coast to Coast AM, with my guest, Rich Dolan. Stick around. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp, joined by historian and author Rich Dolan, author of UFOs and the National Security State. We're talking about UFO cover-ups. Rich, what is it that's being covered up? I mean, there's a lot of speculation that we've recovered saucers and bodies and pieces, parts, and things of that sort over the years. Do you have a firm idea about what it is that our government formerly possessed and now multinational corporations may possess?
Well, I suspect that going back to the 50s and 60s, that fiber optics was probably developed as a result of our possession of alien technology. That doesn't mean that it was not done with any kind of Native American know-how, as Ben Rich might have put it, but that possession of what appeared to have been fiber optic type technology from, for example, the Roswell crash, if you talk with some people regarding that, that we could have developed fiber optics. Lasers, I would suspect, I would also suspect that improvements on integrated circuit chips would have also been developed with this. The problem with figuring all of it out is like so. You give some scientist, piece of this alien material, and it might take 5 years, it might take 10 years to figure out what to do with this. But then suddenly you get this really good idea, and you might say, well, I can't really duplicate the electromagnetic properties of this thing, but I can create something else. We can create Kevlar, or which I think is another possibility. So that it's very possible that we're not replicating alien technology so much as developing our own versions of, you know, what we're seeing in alien technology. I think that's the case. The reason I believe that we've made breakthroughs is very simple. I believe that there have been crash retrievals of UFOs, and I cannot imagine that those people acquiring the UFOs are just going to be sitting on their hands for 50 years looking at this stuff. So obviously, if you capture it, you're going to try to study it. And there's, when you want to talk about evidence, there's a lot of evidence for numerous crash retrievals of UFOs. So in terms of figuring out what the results have been, that, I think, is more speculative than saying we have teams, military teams, that go out and they retrieve downed UFOs. There's a lot of evidence for that. And this has been going back really, even in terms of the document trail, back to the early 1960s with a document known as the Moondust document, which describes a project, three-man teams to go out and organize recovery of downed objects, including unidentified flying objects, listed explicitly in the document, as opposed to Soviet bloc space vehicles. There are many good, I would say very good, accounts of crash retrievals of UFOs. There's enough of them within the U.S. and in the rest of the world for me to reasonably conclude that we're acquiring UFOs at every opportunity. And I think this, as I say, is what Ben Rich meant by unfunded opportunities.
You know, a lot of folks will say, and you've heard it, I've heard it, well, there's no way the government could hide something like this for very long. Washington leaks like a sieve.
Right.
A secret this big would certainly get out. Your book, I remember reading it the first time and thinking what you took a clever tack on it in that looking at how secrets are kept in dictatorships, Russia under Stalin, things of that sort, and then make the comparison to how it would work here. Explain that.
Yeah, boy, that's a good memory, George. back in the old days, before I did UFOs, I used to do a lot of Soviet study, and I spent a summer as a young guy in East Germany back in 1986, before the Berlin Wall came down. I had a really wild time with a number of East German dissidents at that time. And but regarding with the Soviet example, back in the late 1930s, Stalin ordered a census of the Soviet Union. And now, at that time in Soviet history, there was a massive famine, really a government. The government was responsible for this famine. Stalin had undertaken policies that were utterly ruinous to Soviet agriculture, and millions of people were dying, starving to death. It was a horrible crime. So at the end of that whole famine period, he then takes a census, and sure enough, the Soviet population's down like 14 million people that should have been there were not there. So Stalin's solution was very simple, which was he had all the census takers shot, and the few who weren't shot were sent to the Gulag archipelago. That's a true story. And then 2 years later, a census came out that was much more amenable, had a nice higher population figure listed, and that became the official Soviet population. Okay. Now, that's a rather draconian solution to handling truth. But in fact, all governments, all nations have those who rule and those who don't rule. And so within in the West, in our tradition, it has not really been the culture in which if someone were to disagree that, you know, you'd get a jackbooted guy at your door at 2 a.m., although things are changing in this country. But yet that's not our tradition. Our tradition is more in terms of dominating the propaganda so that people don't have to get to that point. And by that simply, I mean you have corporate control over media and you have intelligence community influence in that media. Today, this very day, I mean, if more than 50% of anything that you were to see, hear, or read in the course of your day is owned by one of five corporations in the world. That's not my opinion. That's a fact. What we also know is that intelligence community relationships with major corporate media goes back right to the early Cold War period, and it has not stopped. There's very, very good evidence, very good studies that have been done on this. So all I'm saying is that if you're able to control spin on major stories, that's mostly all you need to do. In terms of keeping the secret, the government hasn't kept the UFO secret. I mean, this is the thing that we keep coming back to. Can they keep the secret? Well, the answer is yes and no, in a way. Yes, in the sense that secrets are kept all the time, all the time. A lot of the times, the things that we know about what happened in our past, we only know by accident. The mind control experiments that were sponsored by the CIA, for example, these were utterly horrific, horrific experiments, including sensory deprivation on unwilling people and all kinds of other grisly things that were done on and off American soil, sponsored by CIA, and we only learned about them by accident in the mid-1970s. It was a secret that was kept for decades. The existence of the National Reconnaissance Office, the NRO, was totally secret for over 30 years. The NSA, sometimes jokingly referred to as no such agency, was also secret for a long, long time. And, you know, we're talking about major arms of the U.S. government that were unknown to people. So secrets are kept. On the other hand, secrets leak, okay? And the UFO secret has leaked for many, many years. The key is, if you're managing this secret, is not, you can't stop it 100%. That's not possible. What you can do, I think, very well, is you disable those secrets when you need to. A, through proxies in the media who throw cold water on these and throw doubt on anyone, through ridicule. Go into academia today. I mean, you're from journalism. I left academia. It's very similar cultures in a lot of ways, in that there's a tremendous cultural pressure not to get into this topic. You know it as a journalist. I know it from having lived in the university world for way too many years, that you want to get into UFOs, you do it at great professional risk.
That is a fact. Rich Dolan, stick around. We're going to talk a little bit more about media control, and then we're going to get into the mechanics of the cover-up, how it works, the paper trail that sort of points a big arrow at what's really going on. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Hope you'll stick around with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm George Knapp, guest host on AM Coast to Coast AM. My guest, Rich Dolan, historian and author. Rich, you hanging in there? It's pretty late back on the East Coast, isn't it?
Well, a little later than where you guys are.
We were
over here.
Before the break, we were talking about the idea of media control being under control on the issue of UFOs. And, you know, of course, you listen to this program. It's not under control. There are free-flowing discussions about UFOs
That's
and
true.
All sorts of things.
Exactly.
I've reported these things on my newscast many times for over many years. I've written about it in print. So obviously, it's not as you were mentioning, it's not a total control, total blackout. It's, as Linda Howell once said to me, it's a matter of context. Unless you see it on the front page of the New York Times or right there, Tom Brokaw or Dan Rather reporting it on the evening news, it doesn't get the same kind of play.
Exactly. And I have written at length about this as well. I have articles on my website dealing with this issue exactly. You can go to keyholepublishing.com, which is where I'm located. The way it is, it's not totalitarian in the sense, as you're saying, a complete blackout. Coast to Coast has been going for many years, and it's an important avenue, in fact, for discussions just like what we're having. But here's the problem with even Coast, which is that there are many, many excellent interviews that are on this show, but there are always enough. I mean, I listen every now and then that include topics that are just not particularly credible in the opinions of a lot of people. So it's easy to throw out for the mainstream media, NBC or the very, very high powered. They can just dismiss Coast. There can be a huge amount of true information coming out on this program, but because there's always going to be a wide range of quality of people on a show like this, because it's fringe. That's what it is. It's not all going to be mainstream scientists working at some highly, regarded institution. You're going to have people who are out there, and they've got a lot of opinions that are not going to be accepted. So Coast can just be dismissed by the mainstream, and I think that's exactly what has happened. And it's the same with any of the other fringy types of media. Now, it's also true that within affiliates, there's that news coverage of UFOs is always a little bit different. There was a very good study done on media control of this topic by Terry Hansen, another Canadian. A lot of Canadians do good work on this. And Terry wrote a book called The Missing Times, in which he analyzed how there exist these kinds of choke points, so that for local coverage of UFOs, what he found is that local media do a very good job frequently of reporting on a UFO event. He said where the media falls short is when you get to jumping to the national level, the wire services. He said in his study in the 1970s and 80s, he noticed an absolute stopping up of the UFO stories at the national level. So they were not making the wire services. Now, that's the 1970s and 80s. We have the Internet now. I mean, it's a different world, and we have groups like organizations like Coast to Coast. But still, I think it does matter when you can control the spin. A few years ago, Peter Jennings did his two-hour special on UFOs, and I had just written an article on why mainstream media is never just going to admit that this is true. And in the lead up to that show, a number of people wrote to me and said, "Well, are you ready to eat crow now? Because it looks like ABC is about to just do this very serious 2-hour thing." And I said, "No, let's wait." And what I predicted was that they would inflate the balloon for the first half and deflate it for the second half. That's exactly what they did, if you recall. They had a couple of good cases in the first half of that show.
Well, you're exactly right. I've participated in a lot of different programs over the years, been interviewed for these kinds of programs, a lot of them on the History Channel, Discovery, Learning Channel,
and
they all love the ratings jump that accompanies a UFO program.
Exactly.
But inevitably, they gut the topic at the end, give the final word to the debunkers, to the hardcore skeptics, and end up, they'll try to present it as being balanced, but it isn't on balance.
No, I agree. There have been a few. I've done a number of History Channel and Sci-Fi Channel and other documentaries myself, and there are a few that I think do a good job within the limits that they're given. But I think all too many have this, it's a compulsion, because I think they don't want to be seen as, being crazy enough to believe in this stuff, even though it's an amazing thing. I mean, talk about cultural schizophrenia. So many people are unable to talk about this topic publicly. But as you know, and as I know, when you scratch the surface and you talk to some heavy-hitting, well-plugged-in people who know multiple U.S. presidents, for example, and they're talking to you or talking to me about the reality of this, I've had such conversations. The problem is they're just not shouting it from the rooftops because they can't. It's damaging to their career. They're terrified of going public. And so one would assume that if you're a top-level news executive, at some point, wouldn't you have come across some information on this? Well, I don't know. I think some have and some haven't. But there's this very, it's a compulsion that you get with a lot of these History Channel documentaries in particular, to throw cold water on this right at the very end.
Well, I can tell you that the show 48 Hours, an excellent news program on CBS, they came to town a couple of years ago, 7-8 years ago, and wanted to put together a UFO hour-long program, and they asked for my help, both on Area 51 and about some research I'd done in Russia. And
good
sure
work,
enough,
by the way. I'm very familiar with your work.
Well, thanks.
Yeah.
They put together a pretty solid show, had the mandatory, obligatory debunking stuff at the end. But I know in speaking to the producers, they knew they were going to get a big rating spike, which they did. But they also had told me that, look, the correspondents working on this program had to be dragged kicking and screaming into this thing.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to do it because, it does nothing for their career. It can only be bad. And then, you know, after they got the big rating spike, they said, we're never going to do another one because we'd have a revolt on our hands.
Well, and, you know, how does corporate culture really work? Now, I've avoided working in major corporations my whole life. Somehow I've dodged the bullet. But I'm very familiar with it. And I know what this, you go into a major corporation and you want to get promoted, you look at your boss and you watch how your boss talks and thinks and dresses and, you know, does all these things. And implicitly what people do, if you want to succeed, you do that. And your boss, he or she does the same thing, and it goes right up the ladder. There's a certain corporate culture that exists that doesn't promote renegades. It doesn't promote iconoclasts. Those people get weeded out the system. So that, in other words, you learn, I think, by observing around you and by seeing what is accepted and what is not accepted, how you are to act. And I think what happens over years is most people end up self-censoring themselves. It's not just in media. It's in all corporations. You learn to think the right way in terms of a corporate, you know, mentality. And it starts at the top. It doesn't start at the bottom. And so my theory is, and this is within academia also, there's no difference here, because academia and the media have both been infiltrated by intelligence community for years. You learn to think the way it's correct, and you learn very quickly that certain ideas are just too far out there to be, you know, good for you.
Understood.
UFOs is right there. And it's interesting because the UFO one is a topic of intense national security. It's not like believing in fairies. This is talking about stuff that the military is engaging in on a weekly basis. There are constant reports that we have that have come down to us of attempted engagements by pilots, you know, guys with guns in their planes trying to intercept these objects. So this is a serious matter, and yet the ridicule on it is so intense. To me, that cannot be an accident. I can't see how that's accidental.
Well, we don't think it's accidental, and you outline exactly how it's not accidental by tracing the paper trail of the cover-up. And when
right.
we come back after this short break, we're going to get into that. Stick around with my guest, Rich Dolan, on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. I'm George Knapp, speaking with historian Rich Dolan about UFOs and the national security state. You know, Rich, we've talked earlier this evening about the why and the what of the
yeah.
cover-up. Now let's talk about the how.
Yeah, let's
how a cover-up works, how they've managed to do it over the years, muddying the waters and keeping a serious discussion of this out of the front page or off the front page of the New York Times or whatever. There have been some seminal events in this cover-up that you track in your book. And, you know, when we first got to meet at Denver at the MUFON Symposium, we both realized that we were both attracted to this subject in the beginning because of the paper trail. You as an historian
yeah.
and me as a journalist. We don't have a UFO to examine or an alien body, but there is a paper trail that spells it out in very clear terms where this cover-up began and how they managed to do it. Why don't you walk us through it?
Yes, I'd be happy to. I backed into the UFO topic, that's often how I put it, back in the olden times when I was just doing regular, very conventional work in diplomatic history and Cold War studies. In the early 90s, I saw a copy of Tim Good's book, Above Top Secret, The Worldwide UFO Cover-Up, and I thought, wow, cool. I remember flipping through it in like 1993 thinking, gee, I recognize that name and that department and these documents here all purport to be real. So I started out as a little side project. I wasn't really even thinking to write a book, truthfully. I wanted to know, first of all, not even were UFOs real. I wasn't even that far in the game. I wanted to know, was this actually a legitimate historical topic? Was it something that was taken seriously? And if it was, why did all academic historians ignore it? Because would it not be interesting to go back to 1950 to be a fly on the wall in some general's office? And here's, you know, this guy would be talking about the possibility of aliens. How could that not be interesting in the context of the early Cold War? So I started simply by trying to identify what is there to dig your teeth into. And like you noticed, documents. Well, what happened was this. Documents about this were very difficult to come by in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, but they became a little bit easier through the revision of the Freedom of Information Act, which really got underway in the late 1970s. So for the first time, and really a unique period in our history, when researchers were able, with relative success, to petition the United States government for documents pertaining to the UFOs, and they didn't get hundreds, they got thousands of pages of documents. Amazing stuff in some cases. Now, there are a lot of boring documents that get released, a lot of kind of inconsequential documents, and while there wasn't a single smoking gun, like I like to say, there's not a single proven memo from the president, gee, what do we do about these pesky aliens, there were, let's say, a couple of dozen documents that are one cut below that are absolutely awesome when you read them. And it's not like there's just one or two. There's a bunch. These describe military encounters with objects that can only be described as extraordinary and inexplicable, that were doing things that were not supposed to be possible. And we have the record of these encounters. That's the amazing thing. We have admissions from top-level officials that we've got a serious problem on our hands. I remember being blown away by a memo that came out of CIA in December of 1952. It was a memo written to the director of the CIA, Walter Beadle Smith at the time, by his director of scientific intelligence. And, you know, it was during 1952 that there was a huge wave of sightings of UFOs across the country, including many military. And Chadwell wrote a memo to the director at this time, and he says, "Reports of incidents convince us that there is something going on which must have immediate attention. Sightings of unexplained objects at great altitudes and traveling at high speeds in the vicinity of major U.S. defense installations are of such nature that they are not attributable to natural phenomena or known types of aerial vehicles." Now, I don't know how much more explicit you want a guy to get here, other than saying, "Boss, I think we're being invaded." These were not Soviet objects. It was a logical question to ask at first. Are these Soviet? And the answer is no, they were not. Another question is, well, is it some secret project that we Americans have been working on? A valid question to ask. But the thing is, there to this day is no evidence to hang your hat on to say that we invented flying saucers in the 1940s. And if we did, why would you have a secret program to trigger your defenses for over 50 years now and to engage your own interceptors in a hopeless chase? I mean, again and again and again, does this make sense? It doesn't make sense to anybody. So, you know, looking at the UFO problem as terrestrial technology, I mean, there's an attraction there, but there's a limit, too. There are too many provocative, confrontational encounters that our pilots have had with these objects that it just does not make sense to look at these as a secret deep black program solely in that regard.
Yeah, for example, where are they? If they're ours and we've been flying them for 50 or 60 years, where are they? When are we going to whip them out and use them?
Would be handy in some of the wars we've been fighting. And there's not any clear evidence that they have been, although I got a pretty decent Gulf War story, well, Gulf War I, regarding UFOs, and I don't know what to make of it. But, I mean, overall, it's not clear that we've been using these. So, some of these don't appear to be ours. Now, I do think you talked about the structure of secrecy. I've been really trying to figure out how does this secrecy work? I mean, we talked a little bit about, privatization, internationalization of this project, but there are government components to this. And And how does it work? And the way I think it works is that, A, there has to be the theft of a huge amount of public money. And I was really excited. I listened to a great interview on Coast a week ago with Catherine Austin Fitz, who talked about black budget activities and the siphoning off of not billions but trillions of dollars. This is an extraordinary thing. What we do know is that trillions of dollars have been missing from our own government. In 01, just before 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld was talking to Congress about the Pentagon's next year budget for 2002. And now this is, you know, the Bush team was brand new. They were just kind of getting their feet wet here. And Rumsfeld was talking about the mismanagement of the Pentagon in prior years. And what he said is, he said, you know, some of our accounting procedures are so messed up that according to some of our estimates, we cannot track $2.6 trillion in transactions. $2.6 trillion. He's talking about the Pentagon, whose budget was one-eighth that amount. Now, how do you lose $2.6 trillion? How do you lose eight times your budget? Did he misspeak? He didn't misspeak.
In your book, doing this from memory, I'm cheating here, I have it in front of me, there's a reference you make to FDR, and he's finding the money to fund the Manhattan Project, the atomic bomb project, and he tells Vannevar Bush that there's a special source available for such an unusual expense, one that's not going to raise any flags or alert the public, right?
Yes, exactly. There are always these non-official means of doing this, and many people have suspected that not all these means are particularly legal. In the case of the missing Pentagon money, we have to ask, where did this money go? Where did it come from? Catherine Fitz has speculated, I think more than speculated, has argued that a lot of the money that flows through our government is totally illegal. She talks a lot about narcotics trafficking and securities fraud. Stock market manipulation, stuff that's well beyond my ability to study and analyze, but she seems to know what she's talking about. I think that there's a lot of phony business going on. And so step one for the secrecy is you've got to get a huge stash of money that you can play with that's not accountable. Because if it's all standard appropriations through Congress, someone's going to figure it out. So you can't have it out in the open. That's the whole thing. I think what we really need to do, and Catherine is at the vanguard here, is we have to rethink the black budget and see it as much more than just classified spending. It's the siphoning off of huge amounts of money frequently, to groups that have no oversight. Now, within the UFO context, I have very good reason for believing that through in the Pentagon there are what are known as special access programs, or SAP. There hasn't been a lot of journalistic work done on SAPs. There's been a little bit. There's been some. A very good article by a gentleman, Bill Sweetman, a leading aviation writer.
I know Bill Sweetman, and if you'll hold that thought, we'll come back and talk about that in detail. We'll also get into the concept of debunking and disinformation, because the paper trail shows us those two are very real. I'm George Knapp, and I'll be right back with more of my guest, Rich Dolan, on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone. I'm George Knapp. Glad to be here, as always, as your guest host, and our guest tonight, Rich Dolan, getting into some very heavy-duty stuff about the ongoing UFO cover-up. Rich, before the break, we were talking about special access programs and billions, perhaps trillions of dollars missing from the federal budget, some of which could have been used to keep this thing going. I'll tell you, before we get back to that, a story that was told to me, there was a guy, a congressional investigator, who had the top security clearances in the early 90s. He traveled around the country and met with a handful of UFO researchers trying to get to the bottom of the whole story, the whole truth, on the behalf of some people in Congress. And one of the trips he made was out here to Nevada, and he wanted to know about Area 51, and we had many conversations back in those days. And he explained to me that he agreed with your thesis that the program had been taken out of the hands of the military, that it was in private, the private arena now. And he said if and when the truth about the UFO cover-up comes out, people will go to jail because he felt that billions and billions of dollars had been siphoned from legitimate national security programs to keep this lie going. And he felt that that was one of the most important reasons for the cover-up to continue, because people's butts were on the line.
Yeah, I agree completely, and I did not know that story. That's fascinating, George. And it's also in line with a lot of other things that other researchers like myself have been getting. A number of members of Congress have suspected that they are totally out of the loop on this. The study by Bill Sweetman that I found so interesting, actually it was an article he did in early 2000, this is going back a little bit now, for Jane's International Defense Review, I believe. It was an article called In Search of the Pentagon's Billion-Dollar Hidden Budgets, How the U.S. Keeps Its R&D Spending Under Wraps. And it was really a study of these special access programs. And again, you know, it's important to emphasize that there's been very little work done publicly on these special access programs. And I think Sweetman did, as far as non-classified articles, it's the best one that I've still seen. At that time, he estimated that there were about 150 special access programs within the Defense Department. And the thing he said about them was, A, there was no oversight. There's no congressional oversight over these programs. And that many of these SAPs were unacknowledged. So that, in other words, they didn't exist, but of course they did exist, they just didn't exist officially. One thing he noted about these programs is that they appeared to have completely independent classification systems. In other words, systems that did not bear a relationship to the standard, secret, top secret types of classifications that we are familiar with. And that, in other words, each SAP's project manager was in charge of determining what is a security classification, who's in, who's out, it's his or her program, and that's that. If a three-star general wants in and this project manager says no and instead wants to bring in a personal friend that he or she trusts, then that's the decision. The other thing Sweetman mentioned about these special access programs, and this is the thing that might concern a number of us, is that in his estimation, they appeared to be mostly dominated by private contractors, not DOD personnel, that the DOD liaison served instead primarily as a gatekeeper for funding, yes, but not necessarily in a decision-making capacity, so that the contractor, whether that's Lockheed or that's Boeing or whomever, that they were the ones in charge. That was his article. That's what you call a white world publication. That's not classified or anything. But I think it gives a very good kind of architecture to these special access programs. Now, let's go a little further and deal with the UFO aspect of it, because I believe that the UFO secrecy programs are embedded within special access programs within the Pentagon. I have been developing my own contacts, and, you know, I'm at the point of wondering how on earth I'm supposed to write about these contacts, because when people come to you, as you know, if they come to you in confidence, it's not like you can just go, you know, giving the game away here. I mean, my training as a historian is to work with open source documents, things that cannot be argued with, but what does one do when you have a number of people come to you privately? People whose credentials you can verify, and people who are known to be familiar with a number of presidents and top-level intelligence figures, and they tell you point blank that there are special access programs designed explicitly to study alien technology and bodies, as I have been told. Now, I don't know how I'm supposed to deal with this information in terms of as a historian. I think of it like the TV show Law and Order, which many people I'm sure have seen. It's like, you know, when Jack McCoy gets a really good case, he gets a piece of evidence, but it's not admissible in a court of law.
Yeah.
Like, what do? You know that this guy did it, but you can't use this particular piece of evidence because the judge just won't allow it.
Well, there's a reason, Richard, there's a reason that people don't come forward, or they can only come forward with anonymity attached, and it's because of the stigma that comes with this topic, and it's not an accident. I mean, in your study of your research into the the paper trail of how this began. We know that the government was secret, the military in particular, were secretly studying this, that they took it very seriously, but they said something different publicly. And then, and in the early 1950s, they took it a step further. They decided, it was a Robertson panel, and you can tell us about that, but they decided that we needed to debunk this whole topic, strip it of its aura of mystery.
That's right. And we can talk about that, because what happened was, in the early 50s, this topic had not yet been completely managed in terms of media. There was a lot of newspaper coverage on UFOs back then. And it was known that there were many military encounters. So what happened was, at the very end of the Truman administration, at the end of 1952, there was, you know, Truman was on his way out. Eisenhower was elected in November of 52. And so this Robertson panel, it was led by H.P. Robertson, was organized by the CIA, and it was slapped together for the last weekend of the Truman White House. It was the final weekend of Truman's presidency was when this panel met, and it was about UFOs, the last bit of house cleaning of the Truman administration. And what they decided was to institute a program in conjunction with media, including Disney, of debunking UFOs, and that was the word they used, debunk and educate the public. So that, in other words, to them, it was a given that they would have no problem working with mainstream media to change public culture regarding UFOs.
They said that UFOs are not a threat to national security, but the reporting of UFOs is a threat to national security.
Well, they did say that, but of course, it's also true that their conclusions were written before they convened, so you have to wonder how much thought they put into it. Yeah, they did. They said that UFOs were no threat to national security, and they were worried about people clogging channels of communication with reports of these things. The problem with that, in reality, is that it wasn't simply people reporting it. It was pilots being vectored in to go after these things. So when you read one after another report, and when a pilot goes up and they get a radar tracking plus a visual, And in some cases we have of the 1950s and 60s, there were multiple radars and multiple visuals. You know, how many times are you going to say this isn't a threat to national security? I mean, and be credible. It's not credible.
And flying over nuclear facilities, flying over military bases, things of that sort, that's certainly, if it's not a threat to national security, I'd like to know what is.
Absolutely. In 1967, there was a fascinating case over at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana in which a UFO, by any rational analysis, appeared to have disabled more than a dozen nuclear missiles, knocked them offline for a day. In 1975, we had another series of cases along the northern U.S. border in which objects were coming over nuclear installations and other sensitive places and just essentially hanging out and then zipping off when interceptors would come along. And this happened a number of times along the northern U.S. border in 1975. There are cases through the 70s and 80s that we know of. Now, reports of these interceptions started to dry out in the 1980s, at least in this country they did. Not in a lot of other countries, but here in the United States, what appears to have happened is that reporting really tightened up significantly. There was an executive order in 1982 that took a lot of the wind out of the sails of the Freedom of Information Act and made it a lot less user-friendly. That was one thing that happened. And it appears that reporting procedures just became much more restrictive. So we don't have as many military confirmed reports through the documents in the more recent years. But I think
the military people know it's about as good for their career as it is for journalists or historians. So we're going to have to take another short break. When we come back, I want to get into the idea of a conversation that you and I had briefly in Denver, and that's about the prospects of confirmation and disclosure and whether those things would be a good idea or not. So stick around with my guest, Rich Dolan. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone. We're speaking with Rich Dolan about the UFO cover-up and the paper trail. Coming up at the top of the hour, we're going to open up the phone lines, and you can ask him some questions. We could go on about this stuff forever. I love talking about it, Richard, but it must be depressing to you, as it is to me at times, to realize that this stuff is really true.
Yeah, I have children, George, and believe me, I would much rather raise them in a world in which this is not the case. There's an upside to the UFO phenomenon, but the downside is that I think it's just involved a further and further emasculation of what we as a country should be, because I just think that it's taken power out of our hands and given it to a secret cabal. I believe that that exists. The opportunity, though, is that when this comes out, it's going to come out. It can't stay secret forever. It's not possible. When it comes out, just like that member of Congress was telling you, there's going to be hell to pay. And it is my hope that there will be a serious cleansing of the body politic and of our society and of our civilization at that time. That's what I hold out a belief in. It's not just a hope. I think it actually can happen, and that there can be good things that come out of this. I hope
you and I, yeah. Well, we both do. You know, you and I talked about it a little bit in Denver at a panel discussion, and the audience was asking about the idea of disclosure,
and
I think everyone was in agreement that that it's something that needed to be done. You know, I made a remark too, and I think I didn't get a chance to finish the conversation because I had to run to the airport. But we got into the discussion of disclosure, and of course, I'm a journalist, and like you, I work toward disclosure. It's what I've been doing for a long time. But I sort of was indicating to you and said to the audience that, you know, the longer I stay in it, the more I have to question whether confirmation would be a good idea, not necessarily from the government standpoint. I believe that it needs to be done, and I would do it if I had a chance to do it. But I wonder what the ultimate truth might be. If it is as simple as ETs visiting us, I think the world would be ready for it. There may be some other horrible truths that would be a lot more difficult for the public to accept. What do you think would happen if confirmation were made by the government, or if undeniable proof leaked out in some way and was on the front page of the New York Times?
It would transform everything, and it is a scary thought. Who wants to deal with an entirely new revolution in everything that they thought they believed? You have the whole religious side of it, and there would be major religious. What would happen to the billions of people who rely on certain religious types of beliefs? Would this revelation change that? It very well might. Then there's the economic possibility. You talk about hell to pay. One insider told me this very point blank. He said, look, we actually have discussed this at high levels, in other words, disclosure on how to do it. He said one problem was lawsuits. Let's say you're one defense contractor and I'm another, and you had an inside track with some fancy technology that I didn't have access to. There was a concern, according to my source, that lawsuits on this matter would be a case. What would happen to the oil industry, to the steel? What if there's a better version of steel that can come right out as a result of this? The automotive industry. This would cause major changes in a lot of our economics that would be disruptive at best. Then there's the energy problems. People talk about free energy as if that's the great thing and that might save us. Well, maybe it will. We're certainly, you know, the argument has been made that we've got some major energy problems down the road, and I think most models that I look at would say that, yes, within the next decade or two, we've got a real problem with petroleum availability. So what if there's a solution in the UFO problem? I think there may be, but there may be problems. Like, for example, you could have energy derived from UFOs that might heat your home for the rest of your life, but what if they can also make a really wicked bomb that can't really easily be controlled? That could be a problem. What if we learn that there's an element of time manipulation to the UFO mystery, so that if we're able to change time in some way, could that be a problem? What would happen to the futures market, right? Now, but there's an upside, too. What if we discover that, for example, we all have certain psychic or spiritual abilities that we've been denying ourselves for all of our existence, for much of our existence. I think that it's only through the imposition of a dramatic new reality that we're really ever going to change. People right now, you know, we're just going through our society the way we are. No, I don't think consciousness is really evolving in any dramatic way. So we're never going to be ready for this. We're just going to have to be forced to be ready for it. But then there's some serious, let's call them exopolitical problems. What if we learn that there are some aliens who look just like us and they live right here among us?
Yeah, pretty disturbing.
What if there are sleeper agents, like people who've been manipulated by them? They may not even know. What if they hold positions of power in our society? I mean, after all, if I were an alien and I were to have people who look just like us in the society, I wouldn't have them sweeping the floors. What if we learn that there are numerous factions of them and they don't all get along?
Don't you think that the possibility of these massive disruptions on a global scale that you're describing would suggest that, contrary to the predictions of many people about a possible government confirmation, wouldn't you say that when you look at all these unanswered questions, that it makes it highly unlikely that the government would be the agent for disclosure?
Well, it's a question I ask myself frequently, like who would be the appropriate avenue for disclosure. I mean, typically we grew up thinking, well, the president of the United States would make an announcement. I still think that that's an important office because people invest a lot in that office psychologically. But the question is, does our government have the ability to undo this lie? What about the aliens? And let's call them that. They're whatever they are. They're other beings, and they are here. I think they live here. I don't think they're just visiting.
I agree.
So, our government's not the only secret group here in this mix. They are secret, these other beings. I talk to a lot of people who say, well, I've communicated with these other beings and they're here to help us. They're worried about our environment. They're worried about whatever. Well, you know, maybe some of them are, but others come into people's bedrooms and take them and do things to them. I'm not sure I would want my children left alone in a room with some of these creatures. So, here to help us, they're not doing much to help us.
Yeah, I agree with you. I get a little tired of the infomercials for the aliens, you know, these ads that how generous and helpful they could be, because Where the heck is it? It certainly isn't obvious.
I'm not convinced that they're all here out to get us or to have us for lunch, but I'm also not convinced that all of them are benign. And so, It's a problem, and if you're a human being and you're at the top of the human power structure and you've got this secret, look, I can see how this is a problem. How do you undo a lie that's gone on for nearly as long as the entire age of the old Soviet Union? I mean, this lie has been going on for almost 70 years now. And the Soviet Union, it's a good analogy because, you know, back in 1985, Gorbachev took power and he comes in on this platform of glasnost, openness, and restructuring. 6 years later, there was no Soviet Union. It was all gone because the process of reform spiraled out of control, and it could happen here.
Hold on to that. We're going to come back to it, and I'm going to ask you about the prospects for disinformation, whether there's a government program still involved in that still might be in existence. And then after that question, we open up it to the phone lines with your questions for Rich Dolan. I'm George Knapp, and we'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. I'm George Knapp. We're in the home stretch of our conversation, our fascinating conversation with historian Richard Dolan, author of UFOs and the National Security State, one of the most important UFO books ever written. And I know that Rich is hard at work on volume 2. And man, this is a hefty project. I want to ask one more question, Rich, before we go to the phone lines. And you've already outlined, as you have in your book, that the government's been lying to us for a long time, that they secretly studied UFOs, that they concluded this is serious business. They told the public something entirely different.
Right.
And then they instituted a program of debunking and disinformation. Your thesis is that the program itself, the hardware, maybe the bodies, has been moved out of the purview of government into private industry. I wonder if that same thing still holds true for disinformation efforts, you know, where there were discussions, of course, about whether something like a Majestic 12 ever existed, that there are hit squads, essentially, that go out and manipulate the media. Do you think anything like that still exists, or is it no longer necessary?
I believe it does exist. I think that there are active links between the right government people and the right media people. There was a study, this was done years ago by the legendary journalist Carl Bernstein of All the President's Men fame. Back in 1977, Bernstein wrote a study that appeared in Rolling Stone magazine dealing with the CIA's relationship with mainstream American journalism at that time. Mentioned over 400 mainstream journalists having been on the CIA payroll without anybody knowing during the Cold War. The CIA quickly said, well, we don't do that anymore. That's not our way. That's the old CIA. That's not the new CIA. But there were a number of statements during the 1990s in which the CIA director said, well, in fact, we reserve the right to do that, to have relationships with, paid relationships with journalists. But in fact, it doesn't even work that simply anymore. What we find is that many journalists actively cultivate relationships with the CIA and with other government agencies because they want the inside track. I mean, look, we've had a couple of wars with embedded journalists, for God's sake. So, in fact, this is the easiest thing in the world to have proxies do your work for you. 10 years ago, there was the journalist Gary Webb who wrote a very important three-part article dealing with cocaine trafficking and its possible connections to the CIA. He wrote a three-part piece called Dark Alliance, in which he posited that based on his research, the CIA was wittingly allowing cocaine being shipped in through the 1980s through the Contras in connection with the Medellin cartel and L.A. gangs like the Bloods and Crips. When Webb wrote that article in 1996, he was hung out to dry, and the people who attacked him were not, it wasn't the CIA. The CIA stood back and said, well, we have no knowledge of this, and they just watched the Washington Post and the L.A. Times and the New York Times tear Gary Webb to pieces. And you know what's really scary about Gary Webb's story? He was out of a job within a year. 10 years after that, and I think it was in 05 or 06, Gary Webb died of not one, but two self-inflicted gunshot wounds to the head.
That's not something to laugh about. Yeah.
And it was ruled a suicide.
Oh, man.
So if he had been killed right away, that would have been very suspicious. So, look, how hard is it to imagine? You wait a few years, and then you whack him, and the people, you know, anyone involved in that, they know. So, will there ever be proof that Gary Webb was murdered? Doubt it. Doubt it. But the message is there.
I know the Coast listeners are anxious to ask you some questions. Let's go to the phone lines. I know our first-time caller, Harry, has been hanging on there in Baltimore. Harry, what's on your mind?
Hello, how you guys doing today? I had a quick comment to make and a question. You guys were talking earlier about how private contractors are in bed with aliens or whatever. Did you know that Bush, actually his father, Bush Senior, has a lot of money in private weapon contracts? He has a lot of money in that.
Yes, he absolutely. George Bush Senior has been one of the, he gets huge amounts of money. And he's associated with the largest non-publicly held weapons contracting group in the country, as far as I know, and they have a very close ear to the president. In fact, this was featured, among other places, in Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11. That's called the Carlyle Group.
And the grandfather, too, right? The grandfather was involved in weapons trade, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, the grandfather, Prescott Bush, a senator, was investigated and nearly arrested by J. Edgar Hoover during World War II. As we like to say, you can look it up. Prescott Bush was being investigated for financing armaments and weapons for the Third Reich before and during World War II, and then that ended. Prescott Bush was politically safe, it's believed, because he was one of the founders of the USO. Think Bob Hope, you know, going overseas. That's what they did. He became off limits and as far as I know broke off the relationship, but this family goes back a long way. They've had a lot of questionable, you know, transactions and long history. And of course then you get the whole skull and bones connection, but we don't have to get into that.
Harry,
but I want to clarify, I didn't say private contractors were in bed with aliens per se. But, I mean, I take your point, so we'll just let it go with that.
Was that it, Harry?
No, I had another question to go with that comment I made. Now, I was, like, 2 years ago, I was watching the History Channel, and they had this, I think it was Modern Marvels, and they were talking about these rockets they have that can actually do maneuvers faster than a helicopter, but do the same maneuvers, like move side to side, come down, go up real quick. And they actually show real live footage of these rockets. My question to you is, what percentage of UFO sightings do you think could have been of aircraft like this? And take my answer off there.
Good question.
Thanks, sir.
You know, this is a guy who's in my time zone, so I really respect anyone who stays on hold at 4 a.m. Modern Marvels, I think, is a really interesting show. They got a lot of neat stuff. There is amazing technology that is not fully acknowledged that's out there. Are some of these mistaken for UFOs? Well, they certainly could be. A great example of one that's still under dispute, but I think shouldn't be disputed, is the Nellis Air Force Base video footage of 1994. This is an utterly extraordinary piece of video that was smuggled out of Nellis, made it to the TV show Hard Copy in early 1995, and we've had it ever since. You can look it up on YouTube. You can look at the whole thing. It's a couple of minutes long. This video has been analyzed, and what it shows is an object. It's very non-aerodynamic looking. It looks like a kind of disc-like, somewhat, almost like a ball. And it's moving, and we're able to track its movements because there's speed and there's like distance and azimuth and all these other things on the video itself, so you can study how this thing moves. This object moved from as slowly as 20 miles per hour to as rapidly as 500 miles per hour, all within 2 minutes. It did a right angle turn at about 140 miles per hour in 1994. Now, who made that? Presumably, we did. It's not certain. I would imagine you could argue maybe the aliens made that, but I'm thinking we made that. It was at Nellis Testing Range. It was being videoed by our people. So, in other words, there has been some amazing stuff that's been out there for some time. I'd like to know what makes the Nellis object move in the way that it did. Is it just high-octane gasoline, or is it something else?
Yeah, they're putting something in the tank. We need to take a short break again. We'll go back to the phone line. Stick around for Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Our guest is Richard Dolan, and we're going to plow through some phone calls here. Let's go to the East of the Rockies line, John in Winnipeg. John, what's going on?
Hey, guys. Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Hey, John.
What a great opportunity this is. What a joy. You know, where to start? You know, if aliens were smart enough to traverse the universe, I think they just remind us that there are indivisible truths that we all share as equals. You know, you were talking earlier about how America, or the emasculation of America, is due to the actions of a secret cabal, but it's really not secret. It's just like, as you said, we know that, trillions of dollars are missing, and if you want freedom, you have to have accountability, you know? So I think they would be there to remind us, you know, as I think they have. I mean, with the crop circles, we have Canadian scientists that go out to the crop circles and say the molecular structure of each individual stock of wheat, for example, is changed. Now, we know scientifically that's near impossible to do except by some other scientific knowledge that we're not capable of understanding currently. And you can see, like, that's our struggle, is to admit that there are things that we don't know, that are unknown. And to placate our fears, we like to tell ourselves, well, the CIA really knows what's going on. And perhaps, as you say, some people in the military have figured out how to traverse quickly. But, you know, I find it hard to believe. I think if aliens were out amongst ourselves, as it clearly does indicate something's going on, they would want us to support freedom for ourselves by forming conclusions that stand irrespective of our characters. Like, we know for certain, here's an example, we know for certain without a shadow of a doubt, nobody in America would disagree, that the FBI's formal conclusion is that General Mahmoud Ahmad funded the terrorist actions of 9/11. There's nobody to disagree with that. But just as we fear crop circles, we too fear standing up for freedom and in defense of the FBI and, like, demanding, you know, that would be our first suspect, of course. That would be the guy we would send all the soldiers out to get. But we don't, because we're fearful of that kind of knowledge, those indivisible truths that we would share with any other living consciousness in the universe. You know, if they traverse the universe, I'm sure it would be through a wormhole. And to understand the mechanics of a wormhole, at least theoretically, through holographic understanding, is that all is all. All is in all. Everything in the universe is in everything else. And
hey, John, I'm going to be, in fairness to the other callers, I'm going to ask you to get to a question here sometime soon.
Okay. Well, I just would like to state, would you think that other alien forces, to benefit themselves, would see it in their hearts to benefit us too, instead of looking for an advantage, a way to take advantage of us? Do you think it's possible for them to think that they would benefit if we, you know, stopped indiscriminately killing ourselves or having our pensions thieved or having people at the Pentagon walk away scot-free with trillions of our dollars saying, oops, we lost right. the cash? Well, we kind of know where they are and where the money
okay.
went.
Okay, so we're going to give Rich a shot
question,
at that.
Totally, John. In fact, I love much of what you're saying here. Although I'm not trustful of a lot of what I see as the alien component of this, I'm still not comfortable saying that I think they're all bad. I'm interested in the crop circle phenomenon too. In fact, I have a significant amount to say on it in my next book. And I agree with you that the evidence shows that these crop circles, you can't explain them by simple hoax. It doesn't work. There's too much change that occurs that appears to have occurred at the molecular level of these wheat fields, of these fields that show very localized, high intense microwave heat. And so that throws out a lot of these hoax conclusions, or at least makes them very, very complicated. On top of the fact that these things appear overnight in incredible, I mean, unbelievable, almost genius level complexity, you have to wonder who's giving this message. It's a fair question. I do think it's that for us to really move out of the horrible rut that we're in, a downward path. It's worse than a rut. We're in a high speed, out of control train that's headed for the cliff. We got to do something, and I do believe, as appear that you seem to believe, that a dramatic revelation, a dramatic new way of looking at things, is the only solution, and that solution is in recognition of other, and let us say even higher, forms of intelligence. They're here. We have something that we can learn from them. That's probably true.
As Whitley Strieber once said to me, he said, you know, the aliens are the true architects of the secrecy. They could show themselves, reveal themselves in unequivocal ways. They choose not to.
Yes, that's right. And so I'm of mixed feelings about these aliens, and I guess the reason is because I do believe that there's more than one group that's here. I think that Earth is of immense interest to these other groups. Why? Because we're just about to be able to have the capability to join them, in a sense. I mean, we're on an exponential growth curve here in our own technology, and it's only partly because we're looking at some of their stuff. It's mostly because we're just in a scientific kind of feedback loop here, where we're developing our own technology based on our own previous advances, and we're jumping, we're skyrocketing. And
okay.
Anyone else who can know of us has got to be interested in us, and I think that there's a lot of groups that are here right now watching us very, very carefully.
I have to agree with you. We're going to go to Ricky on our West of the Rockies line from right here in Las Vegas. Ricky, you still there?
Hi, George. Love your reports on TV, and I've been watching you for years. You're a great reporter. Richard, you know, all this would be true, what you just said, if it wasn't. I think they're interested in getting a piece of the action on outsourcing. But other than that, I have a little story that is it'll be short, but it leads to a very important question for you. I have two of the most important people that I know of about UFOs here. Do either of you know what the BAE is?
The DAE, the Drug Enforcement Agency?
No, the BAE.
Oh, I couldn't
hear. Best Available Evidence. That's its nickname.
Well, it's a book.
It's a 168-page report, and it was commissioned by the late LR of New York.
Lawrence Rockefeller.
I'm not saying the name. All I know is that because I was going to do a project on rockets and missiles, and I got really caught up in it, and the detail led me to reverse. I actually, in paper form, reverse formulated the fact that I knew a document had to exist. Well, the person who knows L.R., the late L.R., dropped it in my lap. And I wonder if I was doing rockets and missiles, so I've become now interested in UFOs, but I'm not sure. It comes with a 93-page, it comes with a one-page letter to 93 senators. It was going to be given to them when they met at LR's place in United States. And he was going to, Bill Clinton, and he was going there, he was anxious, he wanted to look into UFOs.
Right.
And there was a section 93 or 92 that had to do with letting this stuff become open to the public. I forgot what the listing was.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure what the specific document you're talking about that you say you have, but this story, I mean, the Lawrence Rockefeller Initiative has actually been written about in a few places on the web, best, I think, by Grant Cameron on his presidential UFO website. I'm writing about it for my next book. It's absolutely true that Lawrence Rockefeller had the ear from time to time of Bill Clinton and of Hillary Clinton. And there's very good evidence that Hillary Clinton met with Lawrence Rockefeller at his Wyoming ranch, which I think what you're referring to, and I think it's Jackson Hole. There's reason to think that Bill Clinton also discussed this matter with Lawrence Rockefeller. The Clinton's whole UFO story is a very, very interesting one. Clinton got elected, there were a number of people who said this is really going to be the opportunity to break the secrecy. I mean, anytime there's a new president, there's always this reason to think, well, maybe now it will happen. And in Clinton's case, it was a reasonable speculation. The reason that it didn't happen is a fascinating one, and it's one that I think I understand, and I'm currently writing about this. Clinton's, I think he had a desire to come out with this. I really believe that, but I think he was stopped.
I know it for a fact, and we can have that conversation at some point, Rich. We're going to take a short break, and we'll come back with more of your questions. For Richard Dolan, I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. We are covering some heavyweight topics here with historian Richard Dolan. We've got about 25 minutes left, so callers, we're going to try to get to as many of you as we can. Some of you have been holding a long time, so please keep your questions sort of to the point so we can cover as many as possible. We're going to go right down the wild card lines. Gloria in Allentown, Pennsylvania, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'll be concise. A lot of people really don't care about what's happening, including that Halliburton got contracts in Iraq. The average household just doesn't care. So as far as the private contractors getting monopoly on steel, if there's a new kind of steel or whatever hypothetical example we have, I'm kind of curious. I mean, I love this show. I think it's great. But I think both Coast and even the non-Coast listeners, meaning people who might get notified by the mainstream media one day, all of us would feel more impacted and more influenced about this information if you could please, Rich Dolan, give us some really good examples of how specific households across America and worldwide would be directly affected by the fact that an international cabal seems to have control of ET technology. And one specific question I have is, could it include psychotronics where there's some kind of radio wave usage where you can kind of zap a person with remote control? Could it include that? Or if not that, then can you give us some examples where, you know, moms and dads and you know, other relatives would be like, this is going to have an impact. Yeah. I'll go ahead and listen now.
Thanks, Gloria.
Gloria, great question. One has to do with money. Now, I don't know how much of the missing money in our society is directly related to UFOs. I believe some of it is. I mentioned the Rumsfeld quote from mid 2001. He talked about $2.6 trillion of missing money. Catherine Fitz has talked about trillions of dollars of missing money. If you calculate that for every American family, you're talking tens of thousands of dollars per person. Okay, so now that doesn't mean that that's all coming out of your income, but it's coming out of somewhere, and it's coming out of something that affects our economy, that's damaging our economy. So there's the money part of it. These private contractors are basically using your tax dollars and my tax dollars to develop their technology without any risk to themselves, really, whatsoever, through secret special access programs. So now, if people don't care about where their tax dollars are going, there's really not much I can do for them, right? There's a money issue. But you mentioned psychotronic weapons. You mentioned, I don't know if you mentioned surveillance. I can't remember. There's many cities in this country that are now instituting total surveillance. I remember driving through Baltimore about a year ago, but the city of Baltimore is completely hooked up. So any corner that you're at, you're going to be videotaped. And they can say, well, it's for your safety. It's all for your safety. They're going to start putting little chips inside your skin for your safety too, right? We're moving toward a surveillance state that I think is directly related to the loss of our liberties, which is also related to the damage that's been done to our republic by the UFO secrecy. So it all ties in. I'm not particularly interested in living in a world in which my actions are monitored 24/7, in which my emails can be read by the government now legally. I mean, 10 years ago they were doing it, but it wasn't quite above board and legal. Now it's legal. So now they can get inside your computer anytime they want.
Not to mention the possibility, Rich, that you're doing something that they find suspicious, whether they've got evidence to prove it or not. They can throw you on an airplane, take you to some dark, dank prison, and let foreign agents torture you.
Well, it's been happening. And, in fact, this is going on with alarming frequency now. And people are not really as aware of this as they should be. So, in other words, American citizens, as you say, George, on suspicion of having done wrong, can go missing for years. This is not America. That's not what our country is supposed to be. So if a person doesn't care about the loss of liberties of their fellow Americans, well, maybe there's just no hope left for them.
Yeah, it's not affecting the cost of a quart of milk or something like that, as Gloria was looking for something that affects
and
her.
That's how it is with a lot of people, and that's how most of my relatives are. When I go get together with my family for reunions, they're not really into too much this whole UFO thing. They're into very practical, pragmatic issues, and I think that's how we typically are. But look, if nothing else, your money is being siphoned away, and it's going into the pockets of people who don't need your money. But their attitude is, why not? If I can get free research, I'll just take tax dollars.
All right, we're going to go to Mark in the Big Easy, New Orleans. Mark, are you there? Hello?
Richard, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, my question is, do you understand that the CIA can siphon funds from every federal agency legally?
I couldn't hear you, Mark. CIA can what?
By federal law, the CIA can siphon extra funds.
Yes.
Every agency in the country.
Exactly. That's right.
Wouldn't that account for the monies you've been talking about tonight?
Well, it could. It could be CIA. My wonder is that it may not only be the CIA. For example, the National Security Agency also has access to, you know, ungodly amounts of money and also has aspects of it that have little to no oversight. Could be CIA, could be NSA, could be another black arm of government that's not even acknowledged. there's a lot we don't know, but you are right that the CIA has been able for years and years and years to get appropriations through other federal agencies, so it's not obvious where this money's going to.
Thanks, Mark. We're going to go to Wildcard 3 and Ann in Walnut Creek, California, pretty little town in the East Bay. Ann, what's on your mind?
All right. I'm going to try to talk really fast. Okay. I'm interested in the effect of this, if it exists, all around the world, and I would assume that the other industrialized nations are being affected similarly, and I'd like to know what they know and what they're doing. May I also very quickly suggest, it's possible, I would think, that if there are aliens, that some or all of them could be nested underground within, somehow under the mantle of the Earth. And this could explain a lot of stuff, like people have supposedly seen craft going, you know, disappearing suddenly, you know, over a ridge or coming out from the ocean, you know, if these tales have been true at all.
Yes.
And also could explain possibly crop circles. But that also relates to what everybody around the world, all the other countries and people are experiencing.
Okay, let's let Rich take a stab at that.
Your last one first. It is my belief, Anne, that there is a significant underground element to this. That there are, I mean, look, if you're an alien coming here, let's say you're not biologically designed to just walk around on the surface of this planet anyway. Solar radiation may be bad for you. Native bacteria, viruses, life forms are not compatible with you, presumably. So what might you do? Well, it would seem logical to me that you might create a secure environment under the ground, one that, you know, you would have the technology, I would assume, to create a nice, sterile, happy, good environment. I do believe that that's the case. There are a number of inside sources that indicate that this is in fact so. So that's a working assumption that I have. The other part of what you said was very interesting, and that's the international component of this. A valid question is, how is it that it's not just the U.S. government keeping the secret, but you've got a global phenomenon? I mean, heck, there's China, there's Russia, there's India, there's all of Africa and Europe. You know, is it realistic to assume that the U.S. Air Force, the U.S. government, the CIA can control all those agencies, all those countries, I mean? It's a good question. Now, here's what I would say. Regarding U.S. allies, European allies, and South American in particular, I would say the answer is yes, U.S. can and does control them. Take something as simple as, with Britain. Go back 20, 25 years. Britain's intelligence has been controlled by U.S. intelligence for decades. When Britain fought the Falklands War in 1982, I believe that was, 98% of their electronics intelligence about the Falklands was coming from the National Security Agency, the NSA. Britain didn't have the satellites in place to get the data that they needed. They all came from American intelligence. So that, in other words, they were beholden to the U.S. national security community. And now they cooperate, they work with it, but who's in charge? It's America. South America is the same thing. There are many, many cases of objects, UFOs, going down in South America and the U.S. military getting control of this situation. And this just in terms of foreign policy, the U.S. is dominated. There's obviously something behind the scenes going on here in terms of eliciting, getting control. Now you deal with other countries, China. China is not exactly a U.S. puppet, is it? So the real question is, what about nations like that have some leverage, some independence? Russia is another obvious example. Well, in the case of China, there were statements made even in the 70s and 80s when China was a lot more belligerent, even in some ways, than it is now, that China was looking toward the U.S. lead on the UFO issue. Now, I don't know.
Hey, Rich, I'm going to stop you for a second here because we need to take one more break before the end of the show. We'll come back to that. We'll be right back with our final segment with Rich Dolan. Don't go away. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We have just a couple of minutes left with Richard Dolan, historian and author. You were finishing up an answer to that question, Rich, before the break about other governments, not our allies, and why they go along with it.
Right, and like in the case of Russia or old Soviet Union, I think there are very similar reasons as to the U.S. silence on this topic. Soviet government had no interest in acknowledging that there was very likely a superior power traversing the skies and oceans and underground of this world. in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, with the Russian Federation, I think the motives are very similar. I think they're thinking about the same kinds of difficulties that American policymakers are thinking about. And I also think that there is some form of international collaboration on this. I don't pretend that I have the full answer on how that is structured, but I think that there is probably that going on as well.
Basically, no government looks good in comparison to UFOs and in the face of the UFO reality. We've got time for maybe one or two more calls. We're going to the wild card line four. Danny in Norman, Oklahoma. You've been holding on a long time. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, well, thanks for taking my call. I've been looking forward to this show since I heard it was, you know, you guys were going to be on. I'm a MUFON member, and I was at the conference a couple weeks ago in Denver.
Hey, Andy. All right.
Yeah, I really enjoyed your presentation there, Mr. Dolan. I have two quick questions for you. One, I'm currently studying meteorology right now, and I know you've done some research that you've probably come into contact with a meteorologist or two. I was just wondering, you know, how receptive they are to the whole UFO phenomenon and all that stuff. And my other question is, if, you know, they can travel through space or dimensions or time or what have you, why have they, you know, stopped you, or someone stopped you, or those who, you know, those who are getting close to the truth, why don't they just, you know, I know you mentioned Gary Webb a few minutes ago, but why can't they just silence everybody who's getting close?
As far as the meteorology component of that, I don't know too many meteorologists. I think I know there's one that I talked to who had an interest in this topic. His take on it was that he thought there was something to it, but in his professional line, there was no way he was going to get into that at all in terms of what he did. It's a good thing to pursue, like what, you know, how do meteorologists perceive UFOs, just like how do astronomers perceive UFOs. The other question is, you know, in terms of, you know, why you're asking, like, why doesn't the government or the secret keepers just slam down on anyone who gets too close? Well, I think they go against people who may be a threat at a certain point. But if you go after everyone right away, that might lead to suspicion as well. George interviewed Bob Lazar 17 years ago now, and Lazar went public specifically because he felt he was safer that way. So, you know, I mean, there are multiple groups out there, even within the government. I don't believe that everyone is out to get me personally. I believe that there are allies, and I believe that there are people to watch out for. So, you know, I've had reason to believe that I've been monitored myself. I've had people who've come into my office who are convinced that that there are bugs in here. I used to get hassled at airports with regularity. That doesn't happen anymore for me, fortunately. So who knows? I don't have all of the answers as to, you know, who they target and who they don't. Wish I did.
Thanks for the call, Danny. Appreciate it. Can we try to slip in on the international line, Bob in Vancouver? Thanks for holding. You got to be quick with this one. We got about 2.5 minutes left.
Surely. I think I may have an industrial component for you that you might want to look into regarding UFO phenomena from the engineering offshoots of Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire.
Yes, okay.
There's an industrial row in Lebanon, New Hampshire, with a very super secret organization called CREARI that does experimental research in...
can you spell it, please?
CREARI. It's a Greek word for to create. And they have developed a number of offshoots from that company dealing with plasma research and jet engines that are completely silent. There is a company not too far from CREARI that designs lights that wrap around the skin of planes. All of this was all developed in the late 1970s and the early 1980s.
Wow.
UFOs were sighted in that area with, you know, breaking some of the aerodynamics, the physics of aerodynamics, maneuvering in the 90-degree...
I'm writing this all down.
Yes. I'm a little nervous. Excuse me.
The sightings that you're referring to, are you referring to the Hudson Valley sightings of the early 1980s?
This sighting was in the Connecticut River Valley between Vermont and New Hampshire near Hanover, New Hampshire, where Dartmouth College is located. It was seen by local police, sheriff, and a lady who is a radio television announcer. There were Air Force Academy students who were seen in living in the area, shopping in grocery stores, Air Force Academy T-shirts on. Something very unique was going on, and these companies along in Lebanon are offshoots of Dartmouth College's engineering department. It was also well known that the Rockefeller Art Museum, it took nearly 3 years for it to be built. There was certainly something going on underneath that museum.
Hey, Bob, we're
in the pocket of research for what I would consider to be your UFO phenomena.
Bob, we're coming to the end of the line here. I think you can probably communicate with Rich Dolan through his website. What is your website again, Rich?
It is keyholepublishing.com, just like you're looking through a keyhole, keyholepublishing.com. That's my site. You can email me through that, no problem.
Hey, thank you very much for being our guest and staying up so late with us. It was a pleasure to meet you and a pleasure in Denver and a pleasure to interview you here. Good luck with Volume 2 of your book. I can't wait for it to come out.
Thank you so much, George. I had an absolute pleasure talking with you today.
Thanks. It was fascinating. Thanks to all our listeners and the callers. Sorry to those of you who couldn't get through. Thanks also to the staff at Premier Radio for doing the great job and to our earlier guest, Dr. Jack Sarfati. My name is George Knapp. This has been Coast to Coast AM, and I hope to join you again sometime.